RTL Original Podcast.
Welcome back to DNA. Today's episode takes us into one of Luxembourg's most significant fraud cases. It's the story of Jos Nigts, the former president of the Independent Postmen's Union, and the collapse of a savings fund that had, for nearly two decades, appeared stable, trustworthy, and well-managed. A fund built on the contributions of ordinary postal workers, and a fund that would ultimately collapse under the weight of mismanagement, secrecy, and speculation. This episode retraces how the scheme functioned, how suspicions finally emerged, and how investigators uncovered the truth behind nearly 14 million euros in losses. To understand how this happened, we must return to the beginning. Welcome to another episode of DNA, Luxembourg Crime Podcast. Jos Nigts was born in 1949 in Sieren, a village in Luxembourg's east. His background was quite typical for the era, a farming family, a rural upbringing, and like many young men of his generation, military service. When Jos left the army, he sought stability and joined the post office. The postal service in Luxembourg has always been something of a social anchor, predictable, structured, a place where many workers spent their entire careers. Jos Nigts fitted in just fine. He showed commitment, participated in staff discussions, and over time found himself drawn into union work. By the early 1980s, he was well known amongst his colleagues. He represented their concerns, negotiated working conditions, and was often the one who spoke up when something wasn't right. His postal colleagues described him as confident, articulate, and always prepared to take charge. He tried politics once, running for the LSAP in 1984, but wasn't elected. So he returned to the union environment where he felt more effective and quite possibly more powerful. It was in this context that the FSFL, the Independent Postmen's Union, emerged in 1985 after a split from the former union, the CGFP. And with it came one of the most significant decisions in its short history, the creation of a collective savings plan for its members. The idea behind the fund was simple: offer postal workers a way to save with better interest rates than what was available individually. Many members loved the idea immediately. Several said later that it felt like a natural extension of union solidarity, pooling resources for a shared benefit. But this fund, unlike professionally managed investment structures, was just a bank account. One account, opened at a local Spurkäsebank, into which members paid their contributions. There were no external auditors, no separation of roles, no formal oversight committee. And crucially, only one person had full authority over it. Jos Nigts. He handled every transfer. He produced every statement. He alone communicated with the bank. At first, this didn't raise eyebrows. He had been involved since the fund's inception. Jos had experience, access, trust, and most importantly, no one imagined that a colleague, a fellow postman, a union leader, could misuse the savings of his own members. Several former committee members admitted years later that they simply didn't see the risk. The fund appeared orderly, the monthly statements looked professional, and withdrawals were processed smoothly. There were no delays, no excuses, and no red flags. And so, the trust deepened. With hindsight, many aspects of the fund's structure now appear alarming, but at the time, they were simply seen as the way things were done. Nigts kept the computer used to produce statements to himself. When questions rose about the administrative processes, he would answer broadly, reassuringly, and often in a manner that left little room for follow-up. Committee members were volunteers with their own workloads and responsibilities, and the idea of cross-checking figures or requesting access to bank records didn't occur to most of them. They trusted that the system worked because, outwardly, it did. And then there was the culture of the era. In the late 1980s and in the early 90s, internal controls and risk awareness in small unions were not what they are today. Digital tools were limited, and many structures relied heavily on personalities rather than procedures. Nick's personality, calm, controlled, always informed, filled that space perfectly. What no one knew was that this concentration of responsibility was already being misused. While the union remained unaware, the bank had noticed some unusual activity early on. As far back as 1989, it had issued warnings to NICTS about losses linked to high-risk financial products. Those warnings never left his hands. The committee saw none of them. No one else knew the fund's money had ever been used for speculative investments. And because withdrawals were never denied, members continued contributing. On paper, everything looked stable. In reality, the fund was being exposed to increasingly dangerous financial bets, foreign exchange speculation, and risky instruments that even seasoned investors struggled to manage. Every loss was followed by a new attempt to recover it. Every attempt further deepened the hole. This pattern, familiar in many fraud cases worldwide, would eventually define the entire scandal. A mixture of secrecy, overconfidence, and a belief that one big win could solve everything. But for now, the truth remained hidden. The turning point came in late 2001. Swiss authorities had flagged unusual deposits into a private account held by NICTS. The amounts did not match the income of a postman or union leader. The pattern suggested something more than just normal savings. Suspecting money laundering, the Swiss contacted Luxembourg's financial investigators. And that is how, by chance rather than complaint, the entire case began to unravel. On the 17th of January of 2002, the financial police summoned NICTS for questioning. What started as routine soon escalated. Investigators noticed inconsistencies in his explanations. They began examining the fund in detail, requesting information from the bank, and slowly a picture emerged that was far more serious than the initial suspicion. When Ecofin, the unit that investigates financial crime, stepped in, they began by reconstructing the fund's total contributions. Members had paid in roughly 670 million Luxembourg francs over many years. But when investigators checked the actual balance, they found only 110 million francs. That meant 560 million francs, or nearly 14 million euros in today's currency, were missing. This was not misplacement, not poor bookkeeping, and not a temporary liquidity imbalance. It was systematic disappearance. Investigators examined the monthly statements that members had received. They noticed some formatting inconsistencies. Some figures didn't align with interest rates of the time. And then came the key discovery. The statements had all been produced by one person, on a private computer, outside of the bank's system. They were not genuine statements. They were templates, modified each month. And yet for nearly 20 years, no one had questioned them. The investigation revealed that the fund had been used to conduct a series of high-risk speculative transactions, almost none of which produced profits. Most produced losses. Over time, those losses had accumulated, and instead of stopping, Nicht doubled down. Some elements remain unclear even today, whether he initially intended to misuse funds or whether early losses set off a cycle he felt unable to escape. This is a point investigators could never fully determine. But here are the facts that they could establish. Nicht had used members' money without permission. He had concealed their losses. He issued false statements. He kept the committee uninformed. And finally, he continued drawing on the fund long after it was clear it was no longer recoverable. As they mapped out the outflow of funds, investigators discovered something else. Nicht had built a life that didn't match his official income, a life of luxury and well-being. Among the possessions they identified were a finca in Mallorca with extensive land and facilities, additional properties in Spain, luxury carpets and decor worth tens of thousands, jewelry and watches valued in the millions of francs, designer clothing and accessories, and a bunch of high-end vehicles. Even investigators were taken aback. One watch alone was valued at more than what many postal workers were earning throughout an entire year. And none of it fit the profile of a man living on a postal salary, supplemented only by union work. Once investigators realized the scale of the missing money, the situation accelerated quickly. Committee members were called in. They were questioned about the fund's operation. Many were stunned. Some refused to believe the figures at first. And then the media got hold of the story. Several postal workers later recalled the moment they heard the news, on the radio, through colleagues, or in the evening television bulletin. One member said he immediately turned his car around and drove home, unable to process what he had heard. Another said panic spread instantly. People rushed to check their statements, but the numbers suddenly meant nothing. The union collapsed in the weeks that followed. The fund was frozen. A liquidator was appointed. In the end, liquidation recovered around 500,000 euros, hardly more than a symbolic fraction of the losses. For hundreds of families and postal workers, the financial damage was immediate and irreversible. In 2005, after a lengthy investigation, three people stood trial. Jos Nicht, charged with breach of trust, his wife accused of benefiting from misused funds, and a bank employee accused of receiving assets linked to the fraud. Some charges fell away due to legal complexity. The fund's unusual structure made it difficult to categorize under existing financial laws. But the core accusation remained that Nicht knowingly used other people's money for unauthorized purposes. He admitted to certain responsibilities early in the investigation, but he never fully acknowledged the scale of the deceit. At various points, he suggested that bank employees had enriched themselves too, a claim not supported by the evidence. Investigators were clear. Nicht had operated alone, and he had acted deliberately. The court concluded that from the very first year of the fund's existence, Nicht had taken money he should not have taken, and he had never once replenished it. He was convicted. For many of the postal workers affected, the financial losses were devastating. Some had saved for decades. Others had contributed modest monthly amounts, trusting they were building a small but important reserve. The collapse of the fund left deep emotional wounds. The loss of trust in colleagues, the shock of betrayal, the shame that some felt even though they had done nothing wrong, and the slow erosion of a community that had once felt tightly knit. The union dissolved, the fund vanished, and the confidence workers placed in their internal structures took years to rebuild. And even today, the Nicht affair is remembered as a cautionary tale, not only about financial fraud, but about the dangers of concentrating power in the hands of a single, unchecked individual, even from the inside. But the story didn't end with the court case or with the headlines it generated. Years after the affair faded from the front pages, it resurfaced in an unexpected form, this time in a courtroom dispute over the very right to speak about it. In 2017, after RTL broadcasts an episode of DNA, the exact episode that this podcast is based on, in which they examined this specific affair, Jos Nikts objected to his name and image being used. He took the broadcaster to court, arguing his privacy was being violated and demanding that any future reporting avoid identifying him. At the time, judges rejected his emergency request, but the case continued through the civil courts for years, and recently in 2024, a decisive ruling fell. RTL was barred from naming him in connection with the affair, with judges invoking his right to be forgotten and instructing media to refer only to the FSFL case and not the Nikts affair. The decision sparked immediate outcry from the Luxembourg Press Council, which condemned it as a threat to press freedom and warned it amounted to censorship. In their words, the ruling prevented journalists from telling the truth about one of the country's most significant embezzlement cases. And so, even decades later, the FSFL affair continues to echo, not only in the money lost or the lives affected, but in the ongoing debate of how the story gets told and the man at the center of it. The story of Jos Nikts is not only a story about fraud. It is a story about trust, how it can blind us, how it can be used, and how its betrayal leaves marks long after the money is gone. It is also a reminder that some of the most significant crimes happen quietly, over long periods, without violence or confrontation. They happen in silence, behind desks, inside familiar institutions, and among people who believe they know one another well. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of DNA. Join us next week for the last episode of the season.